Hello, and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles, and there's a kitten already. I'm a writer, actor, and comedian. And our guest today is recurring guest Carly O'Brien. Carly is a theater director and academic who has worked in higher education since completing her MFA in directing in 2018. As a director, she is interested in plays that offer a glimpse into the human experience through the eyes of characters who don't normally get the spotlight. Outside of her work, Carly enjoys spending time outdoors with her beautiful wife and three dogs. Hi!
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm thrilled to be back.
What are you reading these days?
So I am working on I work in theater, so I'm reading plays more often than I'm reading books. And just plug for plays real quick. Plays are great to read. If you're my students and you're listening, you should be reading plays anyway all the time. You should be using your summer break to read plays. But one of the good things about them is that typically you can read it in one sitting. You can read a whole play in one sitting unless you're reading like Hamlet or something, like a five-act play. So I've really been trying to familiarize myself specifically with the collected works of Sarah Rule, who's one of my very favorite playwrights. She started out as a poet, and then she was in a playwriting class at Brown. And Paula Vogel, who's famous for having written How I Learned to Drive mostly, but she also wrote she wrote Indecent, she wrote The Mignola Twins, all kinds of other things. Anyway, legendary playwright. Sarah Rule took her playwriting class and she wanted to be a poet. And then Paula Vogel was like, nah, you need to be a playwright. You need to be writing plays. So she writes in a very poetic, she just has beautiful language. Beautiful imagery, all of the things that a poet has. Oh, Eurydice is one of her most famous plays. But I'm becoming more and more familiar with her body of work, and then also with Annie Baker's body of work as well. And really exciting stuff, really great female written stuff.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Those are all such heavy hitters. I read all three. I read at least one from all three when I was in college, and I did one of my last projects in college. I did for a dramaturgy class, I did dramaturgy on The Oldest Profession by Paula Vogel,
Right.
which was really fun. It's because it's about the history of sex work in New Orleans, and it's all very musical. And I got to like make a playlist of all these really like raunchy turn of the century songs. It was really fun. It was really fun.
That sounds like the stuff of my dreams. If I could, if I wasn't working in theater, I would be directing music videos, and I would be reading plays and deciding what album, what one album from one artist I want to be the like
My God.
soundtrack for that play. I mean, it doesn't really work because of rights and royalties and things like that, but I'm totally into that. Amen to playlists. Playlists are an actor and a director's best friend.
Yeah. When I was working on Flatch, I had heard a lot of people like before as just a person existing, like heard of actors making playlists to get into character. And so Holmes, the lead of that show, was talking about their playlist, and I was like, oh shit, I should do that. What would my character listen to? And then I was like, no, she would listen to this extremely dry History of Russia podcast that I put on to fall asleep. And so I would just sit quietly in my trailer listening to this British man talk about the serfs. And quietly wait.
Listen, there's something for everybody, okay? Whatever it takes to help you get into character. My students are always saying, "Do you want me to send you this playlist so you know how I'm getting into character for this person, for that person?" And I'm like, "Yeah, send it to me. Like
So
whatever helps
cute.
you,
Yeah.
right? Get into the brain of that person so that you can embody them." Yeah, it's all really fascinating to me.
I love that. We're doing this is our second Dealer's Choice episode where I put out a list of books and said, hey, anyone wants to do these? And Carly picked today's book, which is Johnny Tremaine by Esther Forbes, Newbery Award winner from 1943 about the American Revolution. This is one of the books that I wanted to, like, I've always wanted to do on the podcast because. It is one of the only books that I loathed in school. I read it in fifth grade and I hated it. And all I could remember was like that I hated it and that I think it's a blacksmith and his hand, something happens with his hand. And that's sort of all I remembered, which is true. But so I was really excited to like come back and see what was I on about? And so we were talking earlier, you had never read this book, right?
Nope. No, this is my very first time. I
My
do remember
gosh.
you mentioning that though on the Where the Red Fern Grows conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You said that this is one of the books that made you want to do the podcast. And I didn't realize till this moment it's because you hated it. And you
Yeah.
might have said that last time, but you know, time has passed. But that amazing. I'm so excited to hear what you think revisiting it as a grown-up.
I think in the end, I like big takeaway. I don't hate it. I think in the end, I hated Johnny. I hated the character,
Sure.
which
Yes, yes,
he's
yes.
on purpose. Like Esther Forbes is like very clearly like, yeah, this kid sucks. And then he learns to be nice. And for that, I give her props. She accomplished it. There is real clear character development in this book.
Incredible.
This was assigned reading in fifth grade. And one thing that I was so excited to talk about in this episode is how we as a culture, as a country, talk about and learn about and teach the American Revolution. That's what the book is about. Johnny Tremaine is a blacksmith's apprentice in 1773 in Boston. And he has an accident. He can no longer be an apprentice. And so he ends up working for the resistance in Boston and takes part in the Boston Tea Party. And the novel follows all the way up to Lexington and Concord and the first battles. So I learned about the American Revolution in fifth grade, eighth grade, and 12th grade. 12th grade was because I took an elective, so that was on me. That was on me. But I was interested, like, how I am also from the East Coast. So, like, you know, Boston is not that far away. I was right next to Pennsylvania. Like, I've stood in the room where the Declaration of Independence was signed. So all of that felt extremely close. Much closer than the Civil War, which is odd. I was talking to a childhood friend recently. Like the Civil War happened in Maryland. Like one day in ninth grade, we were just talking about the Civil War, and our history teacher was like, "Yeah, if we like went on a 20-minute walk, we could end up at a battlefield. Like it's over there."
Wow.
So I think that was one of the first things of like, how did you grow up like thinking about this time period in American history?
I mean, when I grew up and was learning about these sorts of things in school, I should definitely mention that history was always my worst subject, like my absolute worst subject. And so I could use this platform to say, oh, yeah, it's because, you know, like a public education needs to be better funded. Yes, especially public education in the state of Oklahoma, which is where I grew up, definitely needs to be better funded, especially the arts in public schools, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not doing that because I'm sure that my teachers growing up were doing a great job teaching it to me. But that does not mean that I was a willing patch of soil for those seeds to grow in. So I think, but definitely I love that you're talking about proximity, the idea that the proximity was so close, so it feels more immediate, which I also think is a theme in the book, which I think we'll come back to for sure. But it definitely seemed very remote to me, to in my understanding of all the things that I was learning in my history classes. It seemed very like a long time ago, all the way, right? And that could be owing to the fact that I'm in the middle of a landlocked state, you know, in the buckle of the Bible Belt. So who knows how that information is getting to me and through what lenses, et cetera. But it definitely seemed very long ago, far away. And because of that, I think that that affected me and my ability to think that it was important. Also, just like the dates and the speeches and all that stuff was just so boring to me. And listen, it continued on through the course of all of my degrees. The theater history part of it all was always the most boring part to me. And then I did an entire degree in theater history. And then I also teach theater history, not as much anymore, but I have to teach theater history as part of it. And so I kind of learned to love it. But definitely when I was first encountering these stories, the Boston Tea Party and the American Revolution and all the battles that were happening, the skirmishes and things like that, I did not pay very close attention. And I think part of that is because it seemed very remote. It was being taught by coaches in my public school, et cetera. So yeah, I didn't have nearly as much of a desire to understand how our country was founded and on what principles our country was founded until much, much later in life.
I love that you say that because in that, I'm like, oh, I have a lot of internal biases that like really set me up, because like history was one of my favorite subjects, and it's because I have historians in the family. Like my mom is a historian, her dad is a historian, and I thought I'm having this is I think 30 our episode 33 that we're recording right now, and so like listening to 33 episodes of yourself, you pick up on patterns, and like there's some things that I'm like, Aaron, stop talking about it, but. Like it is the number one episode to talk about 1776, which is a musical about the writing of the Declaration of Independence, which my family growing up, me and my mom, my dad, watched on DVD every 4th of July, every single, but from my very first one. So I've seen the movie at least 30 times. I've seen it live, I think 3 times. It's and so huge cornerstone. It was the first musical I ever saw besides Wizard of Oz, and I think that has been such a central piece of media for me, because I think of my family as like my dad's family is sort of like the artists, because my dad is an architect and his dad was I mean his dad was a construction worker, but a drummer on the side and a writer on the side, and my mom's side are historians. And I think something that was really special about that musical is that from the first beginnings of my understanding of history, history is made by people who are making individual choices, who have so many internal issues that are coming to bear. That's something I love about that musical is like John Adams is the protagonist, and that guy sucks. That guy will not shut up and has so many, you know, he's such a flawed protagonist. And I think the crux of that musical is this musical number called Molasses to Rum, which is they're writing the Declaration of Independence. John Adams wants the declaration to say that slaves will be free, and North Carolina says, we're not going to sign it if you don't let us keep, you know, the underpinning of our entire economy. And, you know, this moral argument comes up. Ultimately, John Adams has to, you know, let it go in order to get it passed, because, and this I think is something really interesting, is like the Continental Congress said, we are not gonna go to war unless every single state is in, and it's unanimous, which I think was really smart. But there's this musical number where the senator from North Carolina basically is singing about the triangle trade and says, like, even though you, John Adams, do not own slaves, you benefit from this system. You are here at Boston, you're purchasing Bibles, you're drinking rum, you benefit from this system. You are not as innocent or morally right as you think. And I think the whole, like, reading all of this, it's very, I don't want to say it's propaganda, but it is like laying the stones for how we as children think about war and revolution. And there's this line repeated of like, we are fighting for the right for a man to stand up. And that's the repeated phrase, a man to stand up. And the whole time I'm thinking, like, well, all these other characters are not gonna benefit. Like, you're talking, like, there's slaves here, there's women and girls here. Like, none of this is, and I think that was the glaring thing of like, but not really. Like, you're saying X, Y, and Z is so admirable, but that's not really true. And that's not really the case, which was so frustrating to me throughout. I just have so much to say. I'm so excited.
I cannot wait to hear all the things that you have to say. I plan on learning a lot from you in this episode.
My gosh, I'm so glad. I wanted to say before I forgot, so I don't know if this was in your copy. Esther Forbes started writing this book December 8th, 1941. Pearl Harbor happens. She starts writing the next day. And then her two biggest known books in her career are Johnny Tremaine, which comes out in 43, and a biography of Paul Revere, which also comes out in the same year in 1943, wins her the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. And Johnny Tremaine wins a Newbery, which is like the highest, I think at least American award that you can get for children's literature. And she writes about like, or in the introduction, at least for my copy, is like, kids are gonna start understanding war. They're gonna be soldiers around them. They need to understand sort of like why this is important, what we're doing, what our like morals and values are. And I think it is sort of like, classically American that we have this conception of our morals, our values, our ideals of who we want to be, and there are also gaping holes in that. But I thought that was it was so interesting to see it framed like that, of like this is using another period directly to talk about a current period. And I mean, just it still it makes sense that like we as a culture keep telling ourselves the story of the revolution because we are always trying to figure like I America's so fascinating. It is such a fascinating country because we are so young as a country relative that there are so many conscious, active, constant efforts to create a mythology behind it. Something about 1776 that I loved is there's this line that of dialogue that is pulled from an Adam, a John Adams letter that's saying when people oops, when people write the story of the revolution, it's going to be George Washington, Ben Franklin, George Washington's horse, and they did it all three of them together and nobody else. And again, like that these are real people. These are not guys on mountains. These are real people who made tough choices, who like made compromises because they wanted to go home because they hadn't seen their wife in a year. I think this book kind of plays into that, certainly, of the ideal of we're a place where people can be free.
Sure. And I think like the underdog, right? This idea of like the underdog coming up and coming out on top, the idea of like that spirit, like that fire in the belly of revolution, and kind of there's definitely the conversation about collateral damage along the way. And also to go back to what you just said, I mean, a perfect example in the book is it Miss Bessie at the end who's with Scylla, because they end up being rebels, and so they're left there to kind of keep an eye on the house. And Bessie is a black housekeeper. Is
I
that
think so. Yeah.
correct? In the house, and it's she's laying this groundwork in this fictional situation, but it's not just George Washington and Ben Franklin and George Washington's horse doing everything. It's oftentimes the people who have the most to lose who are making the biggest sacrifices. I think about Pumpkin in this book, who makes an enormous sacrifice, and maybe not for selfless reasons. Like he wants to own a farm and own a he wants to take care of, he doesn't want to be a British, like he doesn't want to be fighting in anything. He didn't ask for this, but he ends up making the ultimate sacrifice so that a man can stand up. And there's those players that aren't going to get as much screen time or as much as many props as they need, because I mean, what we're talking about with this revolution, this underdog thing, is that like there are going to be sacrifices, there are going to be people who are lost, and it doesn't mean that the cause isn't worth fighting for, but we must acknowledge those struggles and we must acknowledge those sacrifices if any of this is to make any sense. And I think it's really easy to forget that, no matter what conflict we're in the middle of, right? I mean, this conflict the world is in the middle of right now, if you can call it a conflict. If I had had this book as a child, I think, A of all, I would have understood some things a little bit better. And just the politics in this book, going back to the like kind of the propaganda that we were talking about earlier, there's definitely the right side to be on and there's the wrong side to be on. And like the politics of that, I wonder if that's part of the reason why maybe it wasn't taught in the middle of the Bible Belt potentially, because politically, what's happening here? It's been a red state since the beginning of time. But all really great things to think about. If I had had something like this that was alongside learning about the American Revolution, there's a really good chance that some of the stuff could have stuck in a little bit more. And perhaps that's because of the empathy of it all, right? Like I don't have a reason to pay attention to this person's story unless I feel some kind of connection with that story, or there's some kind of emotional, like I see myself in that person or whatever it is, right? The reason we make art, the reason we make representational art, which is representing, like holding a mirror up to society. What I want to do with theater and what we want to do with film, with any of those art forms is tell this person's story and give an audience an opportunity to wonder what it would be like if they were walking in their shoes, right? And in that way, we trick people into knowing what empathy is. So yeah, if I think that if I had something like this to learn alongside, that maybe it wouldn't have felt so far off, so remote, so far away.
Yeah. Like you were saying, art, literature, especially for children, is often so great in that it teaches us empathy, whether we like know it or not. And I think what's interesting about this book is with Johnny having this really clear, distinct character arc, he is also learning empathy. He is also learning like that other people have feelings, that I have feelings, that maybe I act on things in ways that aren't quite logical or make sense. Maybe there's, value in learning to like curb my really strong impulses. And I think it's very interesting that like the why of it to me felt like why we need to revolt felt fairly abstract. It was like Rab is a contemporary of Johnny's, he's a little bit older. He helps Johnny get his like first job after Johnny's hand is let's do a little plot summary. Johnny works for a blacksmith. There are two other boys who are not as talented. Johnny is like a master silversmith already as a kid. His mother is dead. And then Johnny is trying to finish up a commission for the blacksmith. He is working on the Lord's Day, which I kind of expected there to be more around that. He's working on the Lord's Day. One of the boys sabotages him a little bit, so all of this hot silver pours on his hand, and he can no longer use his right hand. He can't be a blacksmith anymore. So he is looking for work. Rab works at the newspaper and gives Johnny a job, basically as a delivery boy. And Rab is sort of the antithesis to everything Johnny isn't. Rab is very calm. He's sort of, still waters run deep, and he is a strong believer in the cause and ultimately dies in the first battle, or like a few days after, because of the wounds he gets in the first battle. And so Johnny, I think that relationship was fantastic and so interesting. I think of like adoration between like 14-year-olds and 16-year-olds, which is such an interesting dynamic. But like we care about the revolution, not because necessarily Johnny's life is made worse by it, but because Rab cares about it. The whole time I was like, I understand why we're doing this, but like it's not because something happened to you. It's not because like people, the thing I kept coming back to, and I think the older I get and the more I look at the revolution, I'm like, all of this for taxes? Like, all of this because of money? Like there are real, like really concrete things that we could be fighting for here that we're not. Then maybe that puts a lot of current circumstances into perspective when we understand it that way.
Yeah, capitalism from the very beginning. Money is king,
Yeah.
not King George. King George, King Charles? Am I getting it wrong? I don't know.
George the third. But yeah, it's like, Johnny never kind of wrestles with the question of whether or not we should go to war. Which I think like is probably accurate to how a tween would be in that.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
He's focused on the things that affect him. But there are these moments of like, the British troops, I think at some point are like trying to break up a meeting of collaborators. And my mind is like, okay, that's like First Amendment, like right to assemble, right to speech. And those are not the things we're taking issue with. We don't really know what, we just don't like that they're here, that the British are here. Yeah, I think, yeah, how interesting.
I mean, once we have, who is it, James Otis? He comes in and he kind of gives that rousing speech in the attic of the Observer. And he kind of boils it down in a way that makes a lot of the men feel like, okay, yeah, what we're fighting for is good and right. And it's we're fighting for the rights of all men and not just our men here, but we're fighting for the rights of all men everywhere. And like it wasn't until then that kind of the same as you were saying, that it did become about something more for me reading this. But I mean, I also what's hard is that I'm as close to an abolitionist as I could be, right? I'm like down with like the carceral industrial complex, like down with all of it. I'm like a pacifist. I'm like down with war, down with oh, let's just talk about it, whatever. And maybe that's naive or whatever it might be, right? It doesn't need a value judgment. But it wasn't until then that I kind of felt like, okay, this thing that was pretty abstract, like I can get behind that. Like I can 100% get behind that. And the fact that Otis is painted as this, like, oh, he talks and he talks and he talks and he's kind of in and out. Lucid is a word. Like when he's lucid, blah, 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 he's kind of like nutty. He's like in and out of this thing. So that makes that speech all the more powerful because he is lucid and he is coherent and he's making a really great argument for blah, blah, blah. And of course, a lot of the men in that room aren't thinking, oh, yes, we're also fighting for the rights of people who are not us. They're obviously thinking of, oh, yes, I could definitely benefit from this. But yeah, elsewhere in the book, it's definitely kind of just like, yeah, taxes, okay, yeah, because we don't want to pay money to the, okay, yeah. I mean, I can get behind that, but also about capitalism.
Yeah, there's an interesting moment I think that you referenced where it's like we do this not just for ourselves, but so that the people of France, which is like I think definitely a like 20th century perspective looking back at the 18th century of like we do this and then France is gonna revolt and then Russia is gonna revolt, which did happen. Those were both much longer processes. There used to be a podcast called Revolutions by Mike Duncan, and that is what my boyfriend and I have been together for 5 years. We are still listening to that to fall asleep. All 5 years. He does a great
Amazing.
job. But ultimately, I'm sort of like, I don't, are there better books on this subject for kids, you know? Because I like having grown up with, I think, like more or less like as nuanced an opinion as you can kind of get on this thing, like as a child, I to this day, when people start criticizing John Adams's presidency, I get a little personal. He was a terrible president. He was a horrible president. But like because I've had this degree of empathy, I mean, like in the movie, in the musical, he's played by William Daniels, who's Mr. Feeny on Boy Meets World. And I knew him as John Adams. I did not know him as Mr. Feeny. Which is so that's so me of like well, I was different. But I like, have we stopped telling the story of the revolution a little bit? Like when was the I feel like the last thing. So when I was in high school, there was an AMC show called Turn about Washington spies. I watched that. I don't think another soul did. But other than that, like there was the John Adams Paul Giamatti miniseries that was huge in the early aughts. And I texted you about this. There was this like cartoon called Liberty's Kids. I posted like, does anyone remember this? So many people remember this show.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, and there are full episodes up on YouTube, which is great. I did not remember the show super well, but it's about three kids. I think one is American, one is English, and one is French in Pennsylvania, maybe. I don't remember. But the main boy is working for a newspaper, and I played the crap out of the CD-ROM game of that, which was going to different people, you know, different revolutionary figures, getting their story, and then you come back to the printing press and you arrange it on how is the layout going to work?
How fun. I had never heard of Liberty's Kids when you told me about it. And I watched the pilot, the Boston Tea Party episode. And I was just like, this is VeggieTales for history. This is because I obviously grew up with VeggieTales. Well, maybe not obviously, not everyone knows me, but I grew up in a deeply conservative religious cult slash tradition. And so yeah, VeggieTales was there for me as a preteen and as a teenager. And I was just like, huh, this is how like I get to see how the other half lives. Because that's educational in a way that I wish I had been educated in that way. But I didn't know that there was media out there for things for me as dry and as boring for me, for young me, that could have given me once again another perspective into it and another way for me to go, oh, okay, this is really interesting. I see how this is unfair. I see how because this seems unfair. They're trying to do this in order to remedy the situation. And I think that that would have been a really helpful. I just think that for me, there were dates that I needed to know and things I needed to know, but there wasn't ever that line connecting. But why do I need to care about this other than just the assessment of taking a test for it? So I'm thrilled that you had Liberty's Kids, and I'm thrilled that there was a spin-off game
Oh my
for
God,
that. How fun is that?
yeah, I spent a lot more time with that computer game than with the show itself. In re-looking at it, there like Walter Cronkite plays Benjamin Franklin. Dustin Hoffman is in it. The cast is bonkers. Which I mean, I think is very nice and sweet that like I think Sylvester Stallone is in it.
Watch more episodes on YouTube. Now that I know this exists, catch me.
Yeah. Although it's funny that you mentioned VeggieTales because I was raised with no religion. My mother was very much a person of like of I of like one of my favorite things that my mom has ever done, and I think she looks at the religion as like dumb, and I don't agree with that. But once we were talking about religion, she picked up some random book and she's like, "What if we just make this random book our whole world now? Just it's just a book by some guy." And that changed my mind on a lot of things. But yeah, even I watched VeggieTales. I don't know why I did. I don't know how that was in my house, but I sure enjoyed
Listen,
it.
it had some bangers, I'll tell you that much.
Certainly did.
Cheeseburger song, come on, Barbara Manatee, let's go.
Water Buffalo? Yeah, all good ones. Great ones.
Yeah, I love my lips, etc.
Man, I posted this once like a year ago. The creator of VeggieTales has a memoir that I did not buy, but maybe one day, maybe I'll read it.
Yeah, vegetables can't have souls. It's yeah, it's there were a lot of rules with VeggieTales. We don't need to fall down the VeggieTales
No, their Instagram's kind of crazy. There's just some really good memes that have come out of there, like a little piece of broccoli that says, "It's not our time to talk." It's really changed
rabbit
me.
hole.
Sometimes it's not our time to talk, but not here. I think one thing that I didn't remember in the book and that I'm interested that I like didn't catch on to is like the degrees of like spycraft in this book. Like I can really see a teacher trying to like sell the students on like, no, there's spy stuff in it. And I think that is like, I'm still intrigued. I'm intrigued by secrets just generally. And so I thought that was really interesting. And I thought it was really interesting these like little bits of thought of like someone is like leaving town to go warn someone else about something. So they're like, make sure he has a note that says, "I'm going to visit my sick aunt," because they'll ask less questions if you have a note. Or like Johnny noticed that, they hadn't washed this thing or that they wouldn't have picked this horse or something. So I think that was really cool in like laying out patterns of thought to pick out certain bits of information, I think was really cool.
Yeah, they get Dove drunk and get
Yes.
him to spill whatever secrets he has gotten from the British officers that he is working for. And which is another really interesting thing to think about, this relationship between Johnny and Dove, and how it acts as kind of just this, it acts as a landmark for us as a reader to say, hey, Johnny has taken the things that he has learned and the lessons that he has learned, and he is like, it's given him perspective on the kind of man he wants to be. And he's changed. He's a very different young man at the end than he was in the beginning. And I appreciate that Esther Forbes kind of hands us that it's not too late for you to learn how to be a better person, how to learn empathy, how to see the mistakes that other folks make and maybe decide, is that a mistake that I want to make or do I want to go a different way? And we see him kind of projecting that onto Scylla and onto Izzy. And so the dramaturg in me who's asking the question, why this play now, right? Like, why this story? now, why are kids reading this? You know, if I was a teacher teaching this book, I would definitely pull that into the conversation. What is it about this behavior that Johnny sees and says, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to go in that same direction, or I'm going to kind of change, because this is what can happen if I stay here, and this is what can happen if I don't. So I did appreciate that from like a dramaturgical standpoint. I completely forgot what we were talking about in this moment.
No, I loved that you said that about Dove, that Dove is the boy who is a fellow apprentice who causes Johnny's to maim himself. I think I also want to talk, just I'm writing this down from my own memory, about how the book talks about disability, just an issue very near and dear to me. But Dove as this like mile marker of how Johnny has grows and changes and thinks about other people, because he does get him drunk. He's trying to, I think one of the first lines that Johnny says is, oh, I'm gonna kill you someday, Dove. And by the end, he's like, even though Dove like is on the British side, I don't want him to die. Like that he's just a kid who like who makes mistakes, who is foolish, who is silly, who is like following the momentary thought as kids do. And I think it's I think there's both levels of like these kids are so young when these things are happening to them. And yet, like, there are always children in any geopolitical circumstance. There are always kids in revolution. There are always kids in war. There's always, but yeah, let's talk about Johnny's hand. I think I remembered that Johnny had a disability, and I was really interested to see like first how he deals with that and how he thinks about it and thinks about himself, and then how it is treated by the world around him. And jumping to the end, in the final pages, Johnny is with a doctor who says like, oh, I can fix that. Like I can fully just undo that and you'll be more or less normal again. Or that's the attitude we get in the book, which I was so disappointed by. I was so upset by. I think like just talking about disability, like we're both wearing glasses. That's a disability. Like that's an accommodation, you know? My mom also like while giving birth to me became disabled and like lost the use of one of her legs. So it's a like that was always happening during my childhood. I was always really aware of her limitations and things like that and how frustrating it is and how the way that people look at you. I think that was something I appreciated about the book until the end. Is Johnny is so keenly aware of not only what it limits him to actually be like being able to physically do, but it changes how other people see him so much. And it's such an ongoing thing of like he's always hiding his hand in his pocket and he never wants anyone to see it. Like my mom has a leg brace and she always wears long pants because she doesn't want people to see it because she thinks it's ugly, you know?
Yeah, I agree that if you have the courage, I could, you know, just cut back some of that scar tissue and free your thumb and make you not disabled. And how that acts kind of as this like deus ex machina, like this hero that swoops in at the end and is like, I'm gonna fix it. Like I'm gonna make this all okay in a way that isn't necessarily earned. Because I agree with what you're saying. Like, what is that saying? And the reason why Johnny finds such immense hope in this opportunity is because it means that he can contribute to the war in what he thinks is like the most meaningful way. Because he's just been running around, and he's been, you know, shuttling really great, helpful information, the most helpful information to the important people who need it, and how that is just as valid a path toward revolution as anything else. But the way that he wants to contribute, he wants to be able to, you know, be that hero who might potentially sacrifice his life, and he wants to be able to hold the gun and to fire the gun and to shoot the gun and to do the things that everyone else can do. Which, right, as a kid, sure, of course you want that. Of course you want that. But no, I think it's there's this it's not that easy, you know, like it's redeeming. What is it? What exactly is it saying? What exactly is it redeeming when any and all of us are most likely at some point going to have some sort of become disabled in some way that is going to take us away from the thing that we do, whatever that is, right? Whether that's something that we do for pleasure or something that we do for work, and we have to figure out what life needs to look like after that. And I appreciated that part of the narrative. to an extent, right? I think that we get to see inside Johnny's head, and we get to see how Johnny feels about this thing and the amount of shame. And there's that scene in the book where Izzy is so frightened, so horrified of Johnny's disabled hand. And then she has this little moment of redemption later when she kisses his hand and he becomes overcome and overwhelmed with that. This feeling of, oh, I'm just as worthy of this hand of mine that is such an impediment is just as worthy of anyone's attention or anyone's admiration or anyone's appreciation as anything else. So I think that for kids, I think that's a good, important message. You might not always be able to contribute in the ways that you think are the like sexiest, like coolest, most stage time ways to contribute, but like that there's all kinds of stuff behind the scenes that is also really, really important that we need to do. I talk to this, to my students about this all the time because, you know, I'm working on the performance side of theater right now. I'm the head of performance at my institution, and I have all these students in this performance program who obviously want to be performers, but there's a really good chance you won't. And so like all these other things that happen like backstage and all these other really, really important parts of the job, they might not be the ones with the most face time, but they are just as they are vital. We cannot without these things that are seen as like lesser, these lesser jobs, being a dresser, being a stage manager, being whatever, they're just as important. So I think like that message I'm into, but I 100% agree with you that at the end it's like, really? Okay. All right. Well,
It does feel like, well, you're useful in these other ways, but and those are important, but now it's better, right? It's now it's better that you can actually like go and fight, which I think was frustrating, especially because like you have this like this narrative that I know is meant to be like beautiful and moving of like picking up Rab's mantle. But I think for me, it's like Rab's so excited for this and he dies in the first battle. And like, I think something that I keep coming up with is like, and maybe this is naive, but I don't want it to be of like, what did him dying advance, fix, positively change? In the book, there is this talk about collateral damage. And it is a thing of like, I don't think that like the world is improved at all by losing him. I don't know that a solution, I can't rewrite history. I can't be like, here, we're going to fix it. And here's what the British should have done. You know, although I did throughout the whole thing, I was like, thinking about the moment where in order to get the declaration passed, everyone has to be on board. We have to like postpone the slavery issue. And I keep thinking like, what's the moment that we could have been like, actually, if we just change this one thing, everything will be fine. And I was like, is it Columbus? Is there something before Columbus? Like, and that was a whole mental spiral that I've been thinking about. Just like, Aaron, you can't do anything. You can't change any of this. Maybe think about something a little bit more productive. But I liked that you, and I think you said that the doctor is going to like, quote, free your thumb. And I think that's the language that they use in the book. And that use of the word free of like, we're going to liberate the people. We're going to liberate your thumb. It's a little heavy handed, but
hey,
I know. As I said, I was like, gosh, darn it. it's frustrating of like, but you can still, Johnny was still valuable, was still good with his damaged hand. And like, I just keep thinking like there's going to be, I didn't understand like myself as disabled when I was in fifth grade when I read this, even though I like had glasses and stuff. But I mean, this is a Newbery Award winning book. This is a huge book just in terms of children's literature. Undeniably, there have been disabled children who read this book who are like, oh, there's like a character like me. And then they get to the end and they're like, just kidding. He's fine now. And that's gotta be awful because how often do you get disabled characters in children's literature in the classroom that are the central figure? I mean, I was also thinking about this the same year. I think I read a book about a girl who's like covered in burn scars. And I was trying to look up online, like, what's the name of this book? Does anyone remember? And there was a Reddit where they were like, yeah. And the only scene I remember is like, everybody holds hands with the burned girl and it's all okay. And then it sort of feels like that, you know, sort of a Rudolph thing of like, well, if you find a way to like benefit the greater society, we still want you.
Yeah, I mean, representation is obviously important, right? We all deserve to read a piece of literature or see a piece of theater or whatever and be able to say, hey, that's me, right? It's very, very important, especially for historically marginalized communities, to see someone like them overcoming, right, being worthy of love and, right, I mean, it's so important. Representation is so important, but like, well done representation is important, right? I think about Disclosure, the Netflix documentary on the media, television, and movies, and their representation of trans characters, and how, you know, at the beginning, like, you watch any of like the early movies that are mentioned in that documentary, and it's bury your gays, it's hate crimes, it's a lot of these characters come to a very tragic end. And I wish, man, I wish I had made this connection so I could get any of this correct, but here we are. But one of the folks who's talking in that documentary, in one of the talking heads, is saying the solution to this is that we need more. We need to do it in ways that are cheesy and in ways that are bad and in ways that are X, Y, and Z, but we need more quantity so that eventually we can also get like, oh, that's one of the good ones. That's one of the good representations of a trans character on screen or on stage. And when representation is done really well, it can be transformative to the folks that need that transformation. And when representation is not done well, it can be obviously really detrimental or dismissive of someone's lived experience, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, that is a little bit like a little bit too much of a like tying it all up in a nice, neat little bow in a way that is like, okay, kids who are reading this who have a disability, but like it's like that for him, but it's probably not going to be like that for you. So like, good luck. Is that the message? Not that I think that's what Esther Forbes is trying to do, obviously, but the impact, it all needs to be considered, I think.
I think it was I think it's particularly frustrating because I think up until that like final moment, it's done so well. Like the language, I didn't look into a lot of Esther Forbes's biography, but the language is so accurate to like to what it means to be inside that mentality. Like one of the, and I know they repeated this phrase, one of the lines I had memorized or highlighted was, he was maimed and they were whole. And I think absolutely how like the world sees disability, but also certainly like so much of the struggle in being disabled is not only how the world thinks about you, but how the world's perspective on you influences your own perspective on you, and how much like worse it can get because it is constantly like being reiterated to yourself by your own mind. And there's this huge, like, once he becomes injured, the dynamics in the blacksmith house changes completely. I mean, the sort of mom of the house goes from like sort of, you know, just being like a little pushy, a little like, come on, Johnny, like get this done, do this, do that, to being like, you are going to end up in jail. You have no purpose in life. There's a line of how easily, smoothly everything had gone in the old days before Johnny got hurt. And now the sight of Johnny Tremaine standing there in the lower hall doing nothing, good for nothing, irritated her. I'm looking at this page. There's a few things that just like were interesting in terms of like words that we don't have anymore. There's a line in here, Madge had a felon on her finger. I was like, what a,
I had to look it
yeah,
up.
it's
I
a
had to
hangnail.
look it
It's like
up.
an
I was like,
abscess.
what?
It's a hangnail. But I was like, oh, she's engaged.
I just didn't even know where to start with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot about, because one of the things that I had written down that I wanted to talk about was about this idea of expectations, that there's this certain expectation that's talked about at the beginning of the book before he's injured, this expectation that this mom of the silversmith house that you're talking about, the expectation is that he's going to be apprenticed, he is going to take over the business is going to stay in the family. And he is almost like Mrs. Lapham's ticket out, or ticket to continue the thing, to be able to survive, because it's obvious that her, whoever it is, her grandfather, her dad, or whatever the relation
Father-in-law,
is,
I think.
father-in-law. Yeah, father-in-law, you're right. He is getting to a point where he can't work like that anymore. And so it's Johnny Tremaine. She has this expectation that he is going to be the one. He's going to marry Scylla, and it's he's going to keep the thing in the family. And so when that goes away for her, it just becomes nothing but like resentment, because he's not able to live up to those expectations anymore, and he's of no use. It's very much the like, how can you benefit me? And she really just turns on a dime. And the mental gymnastics part of me, the part of me that's like, but what's the trauma behind why this person, you know, I'm doing the mental gymnastics trying to figure out why people make certain choices. And, you know, she's like, well, shit. I mean, like, that's my entire life and my entire livelihood. And if I'm gonna have to shift, then you are now of no use at all. And so she just really, like, the pendulum swings the other way, and she resents him. She resents seeing him because he was supposed to be her ticket out. He never signed up for those expectations, but she had so much weight on these expectations for him. And then the second he's of no use, she wants to kick him out of the house and turn him out and not feed him anymore, because now he's costing her money. And now she has, and you know, her reasons for doing that are valid, right? Survival. That's like all, that's the only way that she can live, is because it's on someone else's labor. And it's up to her to really make sure that all of that is shored up. So it makes sense. But yeah, this expectation that as soon as that's over, like, you're over, you're done, is very, very interesting to think about.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that much from Mrs. Lapham's perspective that you're saying now. I think I had just been like, she's a bad guy, but you're so right that like she has no. The next episode we're recording next week is Pride and Prejudice, so I'm rereading that. And that's such a thing of like mother, four daughters in this, five in Pride and Prejudice, with no way to make money for all of these people that you have to feed. So Mrs. Lapham is like, I have to, this one random 14-year-old, you know, that is just here to work really is going to decide not only my fate and my survival, my ability to survive, but my four children as well. And with her father-in-law now becoming ill, that's another mouth I have to feed, another thing to do. And how frustrating it has to be to like be a grown woman with children who's like of age to be a grandmother, and I cannot feed my family. I cannot sufficiently take care of my family in the ways that is like, especially in a time period where you are, women are defined by their ability to be mothers and wives. Like, I can't even do that right, of how agonizing that has to be. And there's just so little power there. Damn.
I mean, but yeah, maybe she's a bad guy. You know, for kids reading it, sure. Some of the stuff that she says to Johnny Tremaine, not cool, my dude.
Yes, she
But I
is
mean, yeah,
saying,
like she has no power, she has no husband, she has no the one remaining man that is helping her and her family survive is like losing his abilities. And then her daughters are going off and marrying like whoever, right? And then Lavinia Light is like, I'm gonna take Izzy to England. We're going, we're out of here.
This British noblewoman essentially adopts the youngest daughter as if she were a dog, and she like really is kind of a plaything. And so Scylla goes with her mostly to like be the handmaiden to this British woman. And there's, I mean, a fairly like, I was surprised that it was included, because I think I just wouldn't have thought of it, but I think it's very interesting that they include the scene at the end where Lavinia, this British lady, is going back to England to sort of wait out the war, and says like, well, I'm taking my dog with me, obviously. And the rest of the family's like, she's a child, she has a whole family here, she should get to decide. And she ends up going to England, and everyone is like, bummer, but also like, I probably would make the same choice if I could, you know, live in wealth and not in a war zone.
Yeah, and the property too. I mean, it very much for me mirrored this idea that any of the British officers at any point could commandeer anyone's home, could commandeer anyone's horse, and just say the word commandeer, and now it belongs to a British officer or to whoever. So there's definitely that kind of conversation about property and what is property, and like the dehumanization of this character Izzy, which there's already a little bit of that, right? She has fair hair, she's a cute little child, and she charms everyone everywhere she goes. She's always making people say, look at this beautiful little angel. And so that becomes her role, and she kind of takes that up as her role because that's all she knows. Yeah, I mean, lots of side conversations. I also appreciate that Lavinia Light kind of also, as I would say, maybe a deus ex machina as well, kind of just this thing that is just, okay, I need to like tie up this plot point in a nice, neat little bow. Once again, no shade in any way. You want to know how many books I've written? Zero. Esther Forbes gives her this scene where she explains the whole genealogy of Johnny, because Johnny, as we learn, and maybe you can speak to that in a better way. But there's this question of, he's an orphan. His mom has died, and she's given him this cup that symbolizes that he is actually descended from this very well-to-do, like borderline aristocratic family with some influence. And she gives him this cup as proof so that if he is ever completely destitute as a very last resort, he can go to this, the patriarch of this family and say, hey, I have this cup that I got from my mother. And it means that I'm related. I'm in somewhere along the lines, I'm part of this family. And then maybe that this person can show some mercy and give Johnny some resources and give him access to some resources. And that in the book does not go well in any way. But we do have this moment at the end where Johnny does get this kind of detailed explanation of, this is who your father was. This is who your mother was. This is who I am to you. This is who my father is to you. And you were right. You were right the whole time, even though you were being punished for things that weren't yours to be punished for. So I appreciate that as a reader, that wasn't just kind of a plot point that was left hanging. And listen, I love hanging plot points. My favorite show is Lost. Okay.
Ooh.
I love it when not all the questions are answered, but for this, I did think that was kind of a nice little, like, a kindness that seemed a little bit out of character for this character throughout the book, but that, you know, at the very end, she had this kind of moment of redemption where she did give him something that was of some value, I think.
Yeah, it's an interesting sequence of events with the silver cup, because Johnny gets to, when he becomes disabled, he's at that point where, like, there, I don't have a way to work. I need to go to this local family to say and show them this cup and say, I'm one of you. I need help. He goes and they're like, you must have stolen this. There's a trial. And ultimately, Johnny's life is like saved by the testimony of like another 10-year-old or something. It's really, and I think there was something like so menacing in that sequence that I think like could have been. I think there wasn't like necessarily a connection made that could have been made of like how British law works and all of the ways that like this is unfair, unjustified, how like the legal system is not benefiting innocent people at all. And there it's, I don't even remember. Yeah, I think Scylla just comes in, or maybe it's Izzy, and she's just so beautiful that the judge is like, beautiful baby cannot lie. She might be eight, but she eight.
Beautiful baby, cannot lie. I just need a second with that.
It's just those again and again, like those moments of like, I don't even remember what exactly it is, but at some point there's this meeting of all of these men saying like, you know, we need to stand up, we need to fight, we need to be free. 9-year-old serving girl, can you do X, Y, and Z? And just keeps going. And I'm like, that 9-year-old serving girl ought to be free. And I doubt that after the revolution, she will stop being a 9-year-old serving girl. I think all that will change is she's a 10-year-old serving girl, you know? She should not have a career at this point. Frustrating. Yeah, weren't the Americans after all human beings? Wouldn't they care more for their pocketbooks than their principles? I do like how much this book talks to like the power of the press and how important it is to. There's a line from Sam Adams that's, without you printers, the cause of liberty would be lost forever. And I think that was something specific in the American Revolution and certainly in Liberty's Kids of There's a and Ben Franklin, I think, as like is a cultural mythic figure, is like there's a lot of faith in the power of the press, which I think is it, just as more time passes, is more interesting as we cease to really have like news media in the traditional sense, and as media becomes sort of democratized, and what is truth, and lots of long holes to fall down there, certainly.
The power of the pen being mightier than whatever. Like, yes, I'm not saying that in a dismissive way, especially to you, who is a writer. But I think looking at the moment that we're in, and even just, my theater history brain goes to the Gutenberg Press and how that was like a turning point in world history, but it was a turning point in theater history as well, because it became this privilege of knowing how to read, which was at that point kind of only enjoyed by those who had the privilege to be able to learn how to read and to have things to read. And I think that there's definitely a mirror to this, that yes, the press is a very important thing, and the pen is mightier than the sword if you have the resources, if you have access to the resources to know how to read and how to write, which once again is it's a whole. And of course, our founding fathers were considering a lot of things for those who had that privilege to know how to read and write, and those who were literate. But what does that mean for whereas the other version of Johnny Tremain, which is kind of from the perspective of someone who doesn't have access to what they need to be literate, et cetera. But just like a little separate salty thought.
I think there's even a moment of reflection from Johnny where he's like, my mom always, before she died, always taught me to read, and I really hated it, but it's really important now. Which I think it was good. The one little thing I had was just an aside where a guy is shaking his cane at a couple of small boys he had treed in an apple tree, and I was like, treed, I learned that from Where the Red Fern Grows.
Hey, aren't you so glad?
Yeah, that's all.
I mean, I think like if Where the Red Fern Grows was about, among other things, about a boy who was underestimated, I think Johnny Tremain is maybe a story about a boy who was overestimated to his detriment, and now who has to live with that feeling of like, oh, I had so much potential and now I don't, and maybe it's because of this weight of expectations that he, like, pride happens before the fall, and he falls, he has further to fall because of these expectations kind of put on him and this.
Yeah. Well, and I think that was something that like I hated when I was young, but I have such respect for now, is like that Johnny is a very vivid character and has a lot of flaws that I don't think is typical for most of the, I think it's typical for the children's literature that makes the strongest impact, that like sticks with you, is because the strength of those characters. I wanted to talk about the Boston Tea Party a tiny bit, because I think what sets this book apart is that like you get to be present on the ships of the Boston Tea Party of and I think a detail that like I had forgotten about, but that is in the book and is in sort of the historical record, is that the quote, Americans were dressed as Native Americans to do this. They were dressed as Mohawks, and they talk about. So I did a little bit of research on that. Colonial Williamsburg has an interesting sort of article about that. And it's sort of like, did they really do that? It seems like Johnny spends like hours working on his costume. That seems false from my understanding. Other than like he's a child and it seems believable that children would do that. They were not like really going on and being like, okay, we're going to dress up like this and do that. But they talk in like a kind of quote, broken English. They cover their faces with soot. And I think all of it is like, yeah, I understand how like obscuring your face can be valuable when you're committing treason and things like that. In this Colonial Williamsburg article, it's also like there is a degree of savagery in what they're thinking of, and also like of scapegoating, of like if we blame this on someone else. And especially, I mean, Americans have been in the colonies for at least a century, repeatedly experiencing attacks from Native American groups of people because they don't want them there, understandably so. So it's, I like it's such a minor thing, but I That is something that has really stuck with me, I think, on this reading of it, of like, what a twisted thing to do.
Yeah, and I mean too, it's not that it's propaganda in any way, but I mean it's that's not a good look, my friends. It really isn't. And yeah, like you think about the reasons why, and I mean I think what you just said, the biggest reason why was most likely just the scapegoating of we don't want to get caught, we don't want them to know it's me, although don't you want to know that it's isn't that the whole point of the protest? But our understanding has changed so much, which it should have, you know, like there's the question of why are we still producing Peter Pan? Why are we like remaking it? If we're not going to make some kind of statement about like, hey, that was pretty fucked up if you think about it. And of course, not that I think that the folks who made this decision to let's dress up in a certain way, let's use language that we think is close to the way that quote unquote these people talk, not that there was malice in what they were doing, but that's the malice. Like that is, I think, the malice of it is that that community at that point was, we're just going to lean into all the stereotypes, I guess. The savagery that you mentioned in that article, and just how loaded a word that is, just how much of a not even microaggression that idea is. And I think that that too is one of these points that we've kind of circled around in this whole conversation, which is one of those points of yes, so that a man can stand up, but the right kind of man and our kind of man, and how we're weaponizing that against a lot of the people who are going to be directly paying for or who have been directly paying for the actions of these colonists and the things that they've wrought on their livelihoods, their you know personhood, et cetera, all those other things. And I'm glad that you brought that into the conversation too, because yeah, I don't
I mean, I
love
think
it.
it's the only time that Indigenous people come into the narrative at all, and it's they're not even there. It's a reference to their to a bastardization of their image in order to protect. I don't know. It, yeah, for what kind of man can stand up? It's always that like all men were born equal with an asterisk on it, you know? And there's always the conversation always in terms of civil disobedience of like it's okay to break laws that are unjust. But I think something that's so important is remembering when people try to make excuses for others with the phrase product of their time. This person was a product of their time. This person was a product of their time. I think the thing that is always most helpful for me to hear is like, yeah, and there have also always been people saying this is wrong because people who are marginalized have always been there saying, don't marginalize us. And so I think I just like, I don't, well, here's the thing. The book is not meant to be revolutionary, you know, despite its content. We touched on this earlier. There is such this idea of like the valor of the soldier, of like Rab wants to go fight and how beautiful and right that is. And then Rab dies. And there's so much, you know, I think about young men so excited to go into World War I. And technology has so radically changed that you come home with shell shock, with PTSD, and you come out of the First World War, you come out of the Second World War with this generation of people being like, oh, that was really bad. It was much worse than I ever thought. And I mean, this being written in the midst of World War II, you don't have that moment of reflection, but it's just like, I feel like there were other books written in the 40s that probably get, who, what am I trying to say, Erin?
You're doing a great job. You're doing amazing.
Flawed book. Because I don't know. I understand the, I wonder what this book side by side with, Felicity, the American Girl doll that was in the revolution, I wonder how those two things compare, because as a writer, you don't want your character to always exclusively be an observer. You want them to be a part of the action. But I think it would be much, perhaps much more interesting to see how those things have ripple effects in all the small ways to other people, and how war and its effects are so much broader than just the people on the battlefield. And I think we get aspects of that and elements of that, but the focus, and is it just because it's the protagonist's focus? The focus is on the glory of war.
While I was reading this, I really was thinking a lot about it, kind of in conversation with the Bertolt Brecht play, Mother Courage and Her Children. Are you at all familiar with that?
I read it once in college. I didn't retain as much of it as I would like. So
Yeah, no
vaguely.
worries. It's a very famous anti-war play. It was set during the 30 Years' War, and it was written like around World War II time. So to kind of answer your question of like what are other, I mean this it certainly is not children's literature at all. And it was written by Brecht, who was a Marxist. So that shows up in the play a lot. But another thing that shows up in the play a lot is it's about this woman who has a business, and she is selling all kinds of things to people on both sides of the war. She's selling like clean shirts and rags, and she's selling like watches. She's following the war, and her business can only survive as long as she's following the war. But in the process of following this war and trying to capitalize on this war so that she can survive, she loses two of her three kids. One enlists in and goes into battle. One is accused of a crime and is executed for that. And I don't remember all the details of everything because I'm a bad theater person, I guess. But there's a really wonderful documentary that I think is worth checking out. It's on Vimeo.
Ooh.
I think it's probably illegally on Vimeo, but it always is. And I show it to students almost every semester in at least one of my classes. The documentary is a banger. Okay. It's an hour and a half long. It talks about art as political. It talks about how this play is giving like a specific anti-war message. And but it's all centered around a production of this play that was done at the Public, directed by George C. Wolfe, starring Meryl Streep as Mother Courage and Kevin Kline as the cook. Jeanine Tesori did the music. It's not a musical, but it is a play with music, as a lot of Brecht's plays are. And Tony Kushner wrote the translation of Mother Courage that was done at this. So if for no other reason, you get to see Meryl Streep up there struggling, like to learn her lines, which humanizes her in a really wonderful way. But it talks about a lot of things. It talks about Marxism. It talks about Brecht as a Marxist, and his family fleeing. It talks about how he was brought in front. He was brought up as a potential communist, and he testified in the McCarthy hearings. And it's really, really fascinating stuff. But for me, the power of that play is all about this relationship that we have to war, that if a buck can be made, it can be made. And in the case of this of Mother Courage, the character of Mother Courage, it's being made because there's no other way to survive. But it really makes you think about like kind of like that relationship of war and commerce and war and humanity. It's really fascinating stuff. So if for no other reason, you don't have to read the play again necessarily, but definitely check out the documentary. I've been thinking about that a lot while reading this book, because I think there's some things that this book does really well, and there's some things that I think maybe in conversation with that play might be, I don't know, fruitful for someone, for any one person maybe.
There's a progression of Johnny start. And it's sort of disappointing because Johnny goes from seeing the British as individuals, I think, like neighbors and people, and then starts to see them as an entity, as an enemy, as an other. And there's a moment when Rab gets his gun and things are starting to amp up, and it says Johnny could not yet think of them as targets. Rab could. And I think that was an astonishing degree of like talking about this greater thing of like you have to stop thinking of these people as people. And I don't think Esther Forbes puts any moral value on that, but I think it's alarming to not just to kids, of course, but like to anyone to be like, I have to stop thinking about people as people, and I have to dehumanize and distance and all of those things. And I understand why, but I wish she had been like, this is bad.
Yeah, it was a sobering book to read as well when you consider what's happening. But I mean, that conversation needs to come up anytime war comes up. It, exactly what you just said. This, there's a certain amount of distance that is required in order to justify any of it. And, you know, I don't pretend to have literally any answers, right? It's impossible for me to kind of separate that when reading something like this. Once again, I don't pretend to have the perfect formula for writing about war for kids, other than because they're being tested on it and they need to learn it because it's important for us to look at our history as a nation and the atrocities that we have been responsible for, et cetera. I remember when I was in high school, I had to take Oklahoma history, as I'm sure most everyone does in their home state. And fascinatingly, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, guess how much we talked about the Tulsa Race Massacre in my
Next to
Oklahoma history
none or
class.
none.
Next to none or none. You're right. But I just feel like learning about American history and learning about Oklahoma history, I don't have many memories about it. But also, the only thing I do remember in studying any of it is like, man, we did that to the natives. And like I am of native ancestry. Like, man, dang, is this the bad place? Like, are we the bad guys? Which is always going to be part of this conversation for me. And just like the more I learn about X, Y, and Z, the more I'm like, man, am I the drama? And it's like, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I
I
mean,
go.
for I grew up in Maryland, which is the East Coast is obsessed with talking about being the birthplace of the revolution and how close it is, how impactful it is. You know, I've been in Independence Hall, but like Indigenous people were not talked about, like I think at all. And Columbus Day was basically never celebrated. Like the Thanksgiving story wasn't harped on excessively. Like it wasn't an active presentation that things were a certain way. It was the absence of the discussion, I think, which was really interesting. But it is like we did not have Maryland history like as a class. So I know that like Maryland was founded as like the Catholic colony of like Catholics, you want to come to the US? We got a place for you. You're okay here. And that in 1776, you can't have like the Continental Congress was like 100 people. So you've got to pare that down to like, you know, how many people can fit on a stage. So like the Maryland representative, his main characteristic in the musical is that he's fat and that's it. He's always eating and that's it. You know, I know that the Indigenous people in our area played lacrosse because lacrosse is huge, but it's those like bits and pieces, you know? For a place that feels so steeped in history, I think the older I get, the more I realize like also how big the holes are in what we are saying. The absences and the silences are getting louder, I think.
Yeah, I think that's very, very well put, for sure.
This book is fine. Oh well. But I think started a really good conversation, you know? There is so much to it makes sense that this is a time that we always come back to explore, to understand, to better understand ourselves. I mean, that's an hour ago. I just finished The White Album by Joan Didion. The very first line of that book is we tell ourselves stories to live. And I mean, she really, I have a picture of her right at my desk. She's right there.
Joanie, she's always right.
Yeah, I'm looking through my notes. It's like we are lucky men, for we have a cause worth dying for. I don't know if it was this specific one, sentiment just like that has been in my head for a long time. It's so hard to read this stuff. Like, this is the I'm looking at the big rallying speech section and why everyone's fighting. And one guy says, "I'm fighting that no frightened lost child is ever sent out a refugee from his own country because of race or religion." Yeah. And it's like, not only is that happening now, it's like that was happening in the events that you are describing. The people who are, I don't know exactly what founding father this is supposed to be, but no frightened lost child has ever sent out a refugee from his own country because of race or religion. Brother,
I
it's
just find that
so.
it's so impossible to not be critical, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's a downer. Obviously, it's a downer. But it's so impossible to not. Sometimes it's that glaring, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that sounds great. Where do we sign up for that? Like, why
Yeah.
didn't it go in that way? What's, and I get it, man. Like, we're flawed, and we, as much as we want to say, I have this noble cause, like, the noblest cause, I'm sure, is going to have like ripple effects that are going to affect people, and the people it's going to affect negatively are going to be the people who don't have access to the resources. It's going to be the folks who are already marginalized and hurting. And
I think just lines like
so,
that and that how you're talking about how glaring it is, I think it's just like it hits me again and again of like, oh, you really did not see these people as people. Like how firm, how deep, how ingrained that mentality is of like, this is not a person. And it's frustrating because it's like I know that there were kids in that fifth grade classroom who were reading this, who were black and brown, who were reading this and saying like, yeah, but who got all of this then, you know? Who like, I think it's frustrating that like, I don't know, that some people have to be told and some people are aware of it from the first moments that they start being aware of anything, you know, that this is the world that they exist in.
And then how hard it is to unteach or to unlearn that, right? I mean, for my money, like the most hopeful message that I take away from this book is that people can change. And, you know, like for better or for worse, like whatever, whether or not it's helpful to put a value judgment on that, I find a great amount of hope in that, living in a red state with family who fall right in line with most of the things that go on in this red state. And I think about, of course, my experience, because, right, I'm filtering all of it through my experience, my perspective, as much as I do my best to kind of zoom out and see what it could look like for folks who are not like me. And I grew up very steeped in that and participating in that heavily. And I mean, my wife and I literally were just talking about it this morning. Just, I am not the same person in any way, right? None of us are the same person, but specifically in the way that I was brought up to view certain people who were unlike X, Y, or Z that I belonged to, the way that we treat people who are unlike us. And the pendulum has swung so far the other way in a way that is still really confusing. But I mean, it, the amount of work that I've done to unlearn a lot of that and to fill those spaces with something that is much more inclusive and much closer to the life and the world that I wish we were living in, it's an enormous change. It's a shockingly enormous change. And so kind of reading through Johnny's eyes, like seeing kind of the way that he was changing and the reasons why he was changing his mind, right? It didn't, it was a remote and a distant thought to him until it was right in front of him, right? I mean, until Pumpkin died, he didn't really have an experiential understanding of what the stakes were, you know, until Rab was in danger, or until he had an understanding of the danger that Rab was about to go into. He didn't really have he didn't really appreciate the stakes of the situation until it was right there in front of him. And you know, that that's transformational stuff. Like, until you know someone who X, Y, or Z, someone that you care about who X, Y, or Z, you kind of just have your own perspective, and through no fault of your own, right? Until you're thinking about what it is like for someone else to move through the world. And so I think that that is, if I want kids to leave with anything, or I mean, grown adults, whatever it is, to leave with anything, it's that there's always hope for improvement. And it just so happens that this improvement happens when Johnny is acknowledging that, oh yes, these people are people too. These people are people too. That's what I want to take away from this, because, you know, otherwise I'm gonna spiral into the darkness of what we've been talking about.
Oh, you're so right. And that's such a powerful moment when Pumpkin is executed, that Johnny, and really credit to Esther Forbes, where Johnny is like, oh, this is like, he sees the gunshot, he hears it. And I don't remember the exact language around it, but there's a moment where Johnny thinks, like, I have to tell Rab. He doesn't know what it looks like to, like, see the gun turned towards you. Like, he doesn't know that specific feeling, that specific image. I have to stop him. But I think, like you said, there is a lot of hope because Johnny changes. And I think that's sort of the book was memorable to me because of how much I did not like this character. And the character undergoes so much change that I think if he can change this much, then, you know, then anything is possible. I think sort of can be the mentality you come out of it with if you choose. We've been talking for almost 2 hours, which is incredible. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad because this is such a, maybe like a sort of inconsequential book, but a really great conversation to have to start.
Yeah, I think so too. I think as far as like my notes go, I think I didn't, I mean, I wrote down like friendship versus competition, kind of looking at, as soon as he didn't see Dove as his competition and he started like seeing him as someone who is like going through shit too, he's like, oh, okay. It doesn't have to be like that. Yeah. And so maybe I'm just thinking about it like through the lens of like what could kids, what sort of things could like children, young adults
Absolutely.
be learning from this or for that. And I thought that was, I wrote it down.
I agree.
Did you do any thinking? And this is just like the dramaturg, the like theater teacher in me. Did you do any thinking at all of like the significance of the name Tremaine? And if that was like something
No,
for
did
you?
you?
I kind of didn't either. Well, I wondered because I was like, what a weird name. And then I was like, oh, I wonder if it's a play on like remain, like the concept of remaining. But then there wasn't really much there necessarily.
Well, I'm now that you're bringing it up, I'm going to go to one of my favorite websites of all time, behindthename.com, and look up Tremaine and just see if it has anything to say.
I'm always telling students, especially when we're talking about like analysis, like look at the character names. What is the significance of the play's name? Is there anything in there? And then if like Shakespeare especially always has a lot of meaning in his character names too. But I was like, ooh, I wonder, I wrote it down as like it was the first thing I wrote down actually, before I started reading the book. I was like, ooh, look for ways that this could be maybe something in there. Yeah, what does the website say? I gotta know.
Name for someone from any of various locations called Tremaine, from Cornish tre, meaning home, settlement, town, and men, meaning stone. So I will say I saw The Watchers yesterday, which is M. Night Shyamalan's daughter's movie that just came
Right.
out.
Okay. Yes.
Unremarkable entirely, but it's about a sister, and it's about a young woman who has a sister, and the sisters are named Lucy and Mina. And I was like, that's a Dracula reference. I get that. I get that that's a Dracula reference. That was my favorite part of the movie.
Which I think is saying a
Skippable.
lot about the movie.
Yeah, skippable.
Good to know. Good to know. Because I thought about that with Light too, and then with his father's, because I don't remember like what the, I think it was like Latour, Latour,
Something with a T,
because he's French. What's in a name? Am I right? Hey.
Would you consider it required reading? It's a no from me.
That's helpful. As a big permission asker, I needed that permission. My answer to that question is like, eh. If you had to read it for school, great. But yeah, don't run and don't walk.
Yeah, I think it made me hope that since the 15 years, maybe since I read this, let's just put a random number on it, that there is a better novel about the Revolutionary War for children in fifth grade. You know, that's my hope.
Surely there is. We'll find it.
Yeah, maybe let me look at Felicity. I don't know. I never read any of those books. Oh, is there anything that you'd like to plug as we round out?
Sure, yeah. Follow me on Instagram at Prof Carly O'Brien if you are into dogs, or this summer kayaking. I mean, not just this summer, but we're going basically every day.
I love that.
And yeah, it's great. It's very relaxing. It's very wonderful. It's a great way to escape the gravity of life. Yeah, and follow me on Twitter also at Prof Carly O'Brien. I tweet there every so often. If you're my student, read some plays over the summer if you're not already.
Nice. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for going on this journey with me.
Thank you, Erin. You're so great.
So here's the thing. I didn't mean for the American Revolution episode to come out the day before the 4th of July, but we call that serendipity, baby. Thank you so much for listening. I know it's a long one. Thank you to Carly for coming on. I'm really proud of this episode. I'm really proud of this episode. And announcement, if you would like to support the show, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/required reading. It is not like a Patreon. It is a one-time donation if you feel the need, if you feel so inclined. It costs about $10 per episode to produce, so making a little dent in that would be helpful. And if you can't do that, times are tight, I understand, and I'm so thankful just that you're here and you're listening. Oh, I feel like there's something I'm forgetting. Next episode is Pride and Prejudice. It is another Dealer's Choice episode. I am joined by two returning guests, Hua Chen and Ashley Westover. I think you'll be surprised, at least at the beginning of the episode. Did I say it's Dealer's Choice? It is Dealer's Choice. Well, that's all I got. I'm Erin Bowles. Thank you for listening. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. The R stands for, oh my God, it stands for required reading. Ah, bitch.